The appellant, L.A., is appearing pro se. Representing the appellee, State of Vermont, is Caroline Earle.
Mr. L.A., would you step up to the microphone, please, to talk to us? That way your voice is recorded.
Okay.
We'll have a record.
Mr. Alexander, before you begin, I'm confused. You filed a motion to withdraw one of the two cases on appeal.
That's correct.
Now, according to the docket number, it's 026, which I understand to be the decision regarding involuntary medication.
That's correct.
All right. So today we're just hearing your appeal of the decision for continued treatment.
Right, which I refer to as an appeal on freedom of religion.
Thank you. I understand now.
Yes, ma'am.
You can go ahead.
Okay. This appeal deals with freedom of religion. 26 long months ago, I was starting up a world peace organization in Burlington called Kaleidoscope Systems. I was going to finance that peace organization with the licensing of a computer database product, which was based on a concept in mathematics, which I claim was given to me by my God. That concept in mathematics is a solution to a prime number derivation problem, which has existed in mathematics for since the 1400s. The psychiatrist at Vermont State Mental Hospital believed that anyone who talks to a unseen God is delusional. So they brought me into Vermont State Mental Hospital after breaking no law. Incidentally, I have a petition for a writ of habeas corpus in front of the United States District Court at this time, which is requesting my freedom because I broke no law. So we're going to deal with freedom of religion. Now, it may appear when I'm starting here that it's not religion, but we'll get back to that. First thing I want to indicate to you is I've written a letter to Clay Mathematics Institute in Cambridge. I wrote this letter, mailed it this morning, actually. That letter is a response to an article which I saw in the Discover magazine. I only saw this article in Discover magazine last Thursday while preparing for this presentation. In other words, this presentation has come together since last Thursday. It's an article called Million Dollar Math. Clay Mathematics Institution or Institute in Cambridge is offering a $1 million prize for the solution to any of seven different problems in mathematics. It's a contest of sorts, except it's more than a contest because these are ancient mathematics problems. The fourth one of these, I also sent them a solution to this morning. Let me define the problem for you. You have a salesman or a mailman. He wants to deliver mail to every house in a particular town, and he wants to do it in the most efficient manner. It's called the Willie Loman problem, or the traveling salesman, or the mailman's dilemma. That's defined in this article. So if he has four houses, there are only 24 possible routes, so he can sit down and in about 30 minutes he can figure out the best route. But if there are 20 houses, there are 2.4 billion iterations or possible routes. It goes up immensely quickly. If he goes into a town of 10,000 people, it's huge. If he went into Los Angeles, it's immense, it's astronomical. The solution to the problem. I dealt with computer programming. I was a computer programmer in Los Angeles, California for about 12 years. I owned my own company called Kaleidoscope Systems. I was a computer consultant on mainframe application computer logic. I built computer systems. Very expensive. I charged a lot of money per hour. Now, my code...
Mr. Alexander.
Yes, ma'am.
I just want to be clear, before you end your argument, that you know that by your withdrawal of the involuntary medication case, that that issue will be over and the hospital will be able to medicate you.
Well, that's not my understanding because, well, okay, it's a good point because I don't want that to happen. My understanding is that since these appeals all come from one court judgment, that until all appeals on that judgment are decided, then they can't medicate me. It is also my understanding that since the court judgment gives them only 90 days to medicate me, which was a period of time which ended on April the 18th, that they can't medicate me unless they go back to the court and get another medication order. So I think there's two reasons. Plus, regardless of whether I win this religion appeal today or not, I have another appeal, a petition for a writ of habeas corpus with the United States District Court. I think that they're blocked. Now, if I'm wrong on this, please tell me. Because putting medications in my mind, I'm a very intelligent man, and putting mind-altering drugs in my mind is not something I want to do.
I think you may have made a mistake. I think what you were really asking the court was to postpone an argument on the involuntary medication.
I tried to do that many, many months ago, and they played games with me on whether I could do that. So the only thing I want to do is to keep medications out of my body.
Well, just in an abundance of caution, go ahead and address all the issues in this case in your argument today.
Okay. Well, that what we've just talked about is all the issue that I want to present on that. But yes,
have you submitted your answer to Cambridge?
This was mailed this morning. Now, within this program, there's a code section. Incidentally, I want to leave a copy of this with you to show you I'm not blowing smoke. Within this document, there are line numbers on the actual code. There are only 62 code statements, which iterates down through a hierarchical database, which is simply what we're working with to do this. And you can do it with any number of houses. Los Angeles, California, this program will work.
Just let me alert you, the time is getting short, and you said this would come around to religion, so perhaps it should.
The point that I'm trying to make here is, a document and a letter to you contains a behavior intervention. It says I have disorganized thought. The amount of organized thought required to put together this program is immense. I do not have disorganized thought. 4 days ago, not having something to tell you people, my God brought to me, through other people, a copy of Discover magazine, which demonstrated to me a problem which I didn't even know mathematics had. Between last Thursday and today, I have built a program for the field of mathematics which will win an $1 million award, and I didn't even know the program existed. The problem existed until 4 days ago. What I'm claiming is that my God talks to me. I'm an extremely spiritual man. Vermont State Mental Hospital's psychiatrists are atheists. They believe that anybody that talks to an unseen God is delusional. I've been in this hospital for 26 months. I broke no law. I'm very angry about what they've done to me. They stole my life from me. I was starting up a company. I was studying math. I was studying music. I was studying art. They stole my life from me. So I became angry within that hospital, and now they are pointing at my anger as being aside. I'm getting angry now. I was the happiest man on earth 26 months ago. Now they point at my anger as being a sign of mental illness. When your prosecutor gets up here to talk to you, she has nothing except my anger. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Unless the court has specific questions directed to the appellant's brief, I'd like to immediately move to the State of Vermont's cross appeal. The issue on that cross appeal is simply put. It is whether a rule of procedure can create, it's whether a rule of procedure can treat involuntary medication and involuntary treatment orders differently when the controlling statute treats them at least procedurally the same. 20 years apart, 1977, 1997, there were two mental health treatment statutes created. In 1977, the involuntary treatment statute, in 1997, the involuntary medication statute. Those two statutes, although enacted 20 years apart, were intertwined procedurally. The legislature was very painstaking in creating a system which provided for similar procedural steps for an involuntary medication order and an involuntary treatment order.
But if an involuntary medication order is not stayed, then what's the point of the appeal?
The point of the appeal, Your Honor, is to allow the court an opportunity to review the issue. Obviously, what the state is arguing, maybe not so obviously, but what the state is arguing is that it's
been lost.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. What the state is arguing is not that a stay shouldn't issue on occasion from the family court, but rather that these orders should not be subject to an automatic stay. And there's a world of difference in that. The legislative intent, by virtue of the provisions of this statute, indicate that the legislature intended the family court to do a very case-by-case, fact-based analysis of these medication orders, to issue findings and orders which were a result of a very painstaking analysis. The legislative intent was that these orders be treated comparably in terms of procedurally. Rule 12 does not do that. Perhaps the first place to look for legislative intent in this case is the actual section of Chapter 181, Title 18, which is entitled Legislative Intent. In Section 7629, the legislature stated its intent to respect the rights of persons who are subject to involuntary treatment and involuntary medication orders. What the statute and what the legislature said in that instance was that it was going to respect those rights by doing two things. Number one, it was going to put a judicial proceeding in place that would ensure that those rights were respected. And number two, it was going to ensure or put into place a statute that limited those orders to up to 1 year of application before a new hearing was required, before a new burden was required.
Why don't we say about this, the rule, whichever argument we accept, and of course there's only one here, yours, because of the nature of the proceeding, this would better be addressed by the Rules Committee as a policy matter rather than having us do it as a narrow construction of what the words say or don't say.
Well, I think, Your Honor, in that instance, number one, the Rules Committee, it's a rather laborious and frankly a lengthy process. Number two, where a statute conflicts.
Do you know that for sure? Have you tried it?
That's my understanding. It hasn't been tried in this particular instance. I will tell the court that. Where a statute conflicts with a rule, the statute does prevail. This court has held that in past precedent. And so in this instance, what I'm asking the court to do is to determine what the legislative intent is in this statute.
Yeah, but you don't have clear statutory language. You're saying the rule conflicts with legislative intent, essentially.
I believe that the state does have clear statutory language. The section 7629, which I just indicated, I think provides, it's entitled legislative intent, and it indicates to the court and to others that the intent of the legislature in respecting the rights of these persons subject to involuntary medication and treatment orders is safeguarded by a judicial proceeding that it then outlines within this statute.
A judicial proceeding, as we did in this case. The person's rights were not safeguarded in that judicial proceeding. That's what we found.
In this case, Your Honor, I understand. In the prior appeal, I understand that the court did reverse the order. However, that reversal was for a technical deficiency in the order as opposed to a substantive deficiency.
You could call it technical, but it was a question of not making the appropriate findings as to whether or not Mr. Alexander was competent to make the decision. That's the whole purpose of that statute, was to respect people's rights to make a decision.
And I think,
I don't know how that's technical.
I think to focus on one ruling, however, would be a misunderstanding and a misapplication of this statute. Looking at this globally, I think it's appropriate to determine prospectively how the lower courts, are going to deal with the stay issue in these cases. And in terms of the involuntary medication and the involuntary treatment orders, the legislature has been very clear. It set up a similar procedure for both of these statutes. There are a number of similarities in the procedure that is set up. Number one, it is required clear and convincing evidence for the state to show clear and convincing evidence to carry its burden. That's the highest level of evidence required in a civil or that can be imposed on a party in a civil case. The highest probability, as this court has defined it. Number two, there are provisions both in the involuntary medication and the involuntary treatment portions of the statute have similar provisions for notice of hearing, have similar provision for psychiatric examination, have similar provisions for notice to the patients and to other interested parties. And so again, the statute is set up by the legislature to create essentially two parallel courses, procedural courses for both orders. In addition, each order is required to be in effect for 90 days, initially. Every initial order for involuntary medication and involuntary treatment is a 90-day order. They can each last up to 1 year, but again, there is a one-year limit on both types of orders. So there are numerous sort of procedural consistencies that the legislature has built into these statutes. The legislative intent is clear. We hold the state to a high burden here, but in the event that the state meets its burden, these orders are necessary and the rights of the individuals have been safeguarded.
Can I go back just to Mr. Alexander? I'm trying to understand what your position is on something that really never got aired, which is the current state of the federal law on religious claims as to governmental action. It's sort of because I guess he didn't attend all of the proceeding, he never got to talk about what effect the medication would have on his religious freedom, although that seems to be the main thing he wants to talk about with us, and of course he discussed the circumstances. I take it his claim is something like this, as he indicated, he talks directly to his God. He feels that if he takes this medication, that will no longer be possible. So let's put it in not hypothetical terms, but let's say that occurs. You medicate him, and now we're not talking about hypothetically what the effect will be. He reports he can't any longer talk to his God because of this medication. He testifies to that effect. The fact finder believes him. Is that a violation of of the act at that point?
Your Honor, that particular federal act was not briefed in the case before the court.
But he wants to talk about religious freedom here, so I'm trying to understand the claim and its relation to the proceedings in front of us.
I think what he's trying to say is that by virtue of the religion being a factor in the analysis that the trial court, that the family court has to make, that the mere fact that he has religious beliefs and that medication might interfere with his form of expressing those beliefs should result in an adverse determination for the state on an involuntary medication order. What I would suggest, Your Honor, is that the statute does indicate that religious convictions or beliefs needs to be considered by the family court, and indeed I think it's evident in this transcript of the hearing as well as the judge's findings and orders that religious convictions and his beliefs were, in fact, considered and were factored into the order and the findings of the court. But the statute itself does not say to what extent religious beliefs are to be factored in, whether it's to be a prevailing consideration or whether it's to be one among a number of factors that the court should consider. And so with all due respect to Mr. Alexander's expression here of his religious beliefs.
Now the statute you're referring to is the Vermont statute?
7627, yes.
So not the federal statute?
No, it is not. We're relying upon the state statute for purposes of our argument. In addition, Dr. Munson, who was the only testifying psychiatrist in the proceeding below, testified regarding the features of bipolar disorder, which is what LA has here. And he testified that often the psychotic features can be manifested in ways that have to deal with religion. And so whereas someone may be religious regardless of bipolar disorder or not.
How does he separate out a real belief in religion from what is a manifestation of mental illness? How do we do that?
Well, I think what Dr. Munson would tell you and what he did tell you at printed case in 39 in his testimony was that in the case where the bipolar disorder has led to psychotic or delusional behavior by LA, as in this case, that his religious belief is expressed in a way that is punitive to others. LA testified, or LA suggested in his writings, that his God would punish his enemies. So I think Dr. Munson's psychiatric testimony, based on his qualifications, which were stipulated to by both parties below, informs us on that issue. Well, Your Honor, whether it's common or not, we have a treating psychiatrist here whose testimony was unopposed at the family court level, at the hearing level, and he was testifying based on a number of years of observing L.A. and of reading his writings and applying his training and technical expertise. What the family court is required to do by the statute is to take this kind of very expert testimony and to factor that into its findings and order. The trial court, by virtue of the statute, is required to consider pharmacological expert testimony, psychiatric expert testimony, and that testimony was presented by the state in this case. As I said, it was unopposed. Indeed, going back to Justice Dooley's point about the religious convictions, L.A. refused to testify. And so there was no testimony under oath by L.A. or by anyone on his behalf, any witnesses or either expert or otherwise, as to what extent his religious convictions preexisted his mental illness, to what extent those were altered by his mental illness, or to what extent they would be impinged upon by virtue of having medication involuntarily applied to him for his bipolar disorder. The Rule 12 dilemma, of course, is that Rule 12 does not explicitly mention involuntary medication orders. Indeed, the 2001 amendment of Rule 12 does not mention the fact that the statute was revised at all in 1997. The reasonable conclusion is that this was an oversight or a misunderstanding, perhaps, by the Rules Committee of Chapter 181 of Title 18. But the best that we can do for our guide is the legislative intent as expressed in 7629, as an expressed consistently throughout the passages on involuntary medication and involuntary treatment orders in this case. And that is to understand that the legislature clearly and unequivocally required that there be a high standard of proof on the state. It put in place similar procedural guide structure and safeguards for both.
The purpose for involuntary treatment, though, is you're removing a person who presents an actual danger to himself or others, so it would make sense that you're not going to stay that pending appeal if there's been a finding of dangerousness. But when it comes to involuntary medication, those concerns are not as immediate, so could be argued that it makes sense to not include it in this list.
Well, I think there are a couple responses to that. One of them is the concept of kindling, which is what Dr. Munson talked about in
concept
his
concept of what?
Kindling. It's a concept he talked about in his testimony. And what he said, of course, was that and that's at I'm not sure it's at, I think, page 36, but I'm not precisely certain. But that, I'm sorry, 144 of the printed case, or the hearing transcript. But the concept of kindling has to do with the fact that if an individual is not given the medication that's required, that their manic condition, their bipolar disorder, can accelerate and can essentially end up being disabling and possibly not remedial. It's something that they can't remediate through medication. And so, in fact, I would suggest, Your Honor, that the impact of a stay, an automatic stay in this circumstance, on an individual who has for 2 years gone without treatment would be substantial damage to himself and his chances for mental health in the future.
Why couldn't that issue, say, of kindling be equally addressed in a motion for discretionary stay?
Well,
make that point.
And again, Your Honor, I think what the state is suggesting is that Rule 12 should be interpreted to allow the trial court to have that discretion to determine whether or not a temporary stay pending appeal is appropriate. But where this family court judge interpreted that an automatic stay applies, our suggestion is that the statute that overrides the stated intent of the legislature for purposes of the statute, and that it violates the whole discretionary fact-by-fact, case-by-case analysis that the legislature has laid out for each trial judge to do.
Well, one of those analyses requires the court to determine whether there's something akin to irreparable harm. And when you're dealing with involuntary medication, how could that not be irreparable harm? How are you going to fix that after it's been done?
There's no question, Your Honor, that involuntary medication is highly intrusive to an individual's liberty and their privacy rights. There's no question about that. But the reality is that in this statute, the legislature has required the state to carry a burden of high probability. It has required us to carry the burden that is the highest that you can have in a civil case. And it's put in procedural safeguards to ensure that the court makes requisite findings and orders to uphold and to justify.
Well, I get that part, but sometimes you can still be wrong, just like we found you were wrong in the first L.A., not you, but.
May I have an opportunity to respond? I see my time is up.
It's up to the chief.
Yeah, no, please. Finish your answer.
I would respond simply that the fact that there can be an exception and a wrong decision does not mean that we should eradicate the trial court's ability to make discretionary decisions, such as putting in a stay when it deems it appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You got anything more for us, sir?
Did I have 2 minutes? How much?
How much time, Isaac?
To begin with, I have a set of those documents, including the code, which I sent to the Clay Mathematics, which I would like to leave here for your analysis. Now, the way this is presented, even though you're not professional computer programmers, it is presented in a manner that you will be able to understand it. I also have a copy for the prosecuting attorney.
All right. You can leave them right on the table over there.
I'd simply like to say two things. Her presentation, Ms. Earle's presentation, dealt in a general sense with medication. She said nothing to convince me or anybody in this courtroom that I'm truly delusional. If I had claimed to be able to build this computer product, it's a set of computer logic, mathematics. If I had claimed to do this to Dr. Munson and had been provided no way to prove this, that I was delusional, grandiose, and bipolar, he would have said that I was in a manic state. Here's proof. If he calls this a manic state, if he calls this delusional, God help our country.
All right. Thank you very much.
Next hearing will follow the bench case.